Welcome back to Chapter and Verse. This is episode 4 of our discussion about the Sabbath. In the last episode, we looked at the words of Isaiah in chapters 56 and 58. For this episode, we'll finish up looking at what Adonai had to say about Shabbat through the prophets Isaiah and then Jeremiah. And then we'll get into the New Testament and examine what it has to say about Shabbat. We'll start this episode in Isaiah chapter 66. This chapter from the book of Isaiah is speaking of what the coming kingdom will look like. Verses 22 and 23 say this, "For just as the new heavens and the new earth which I will make will endure before me, declares Adonai, so your offspring and your name will endure. And it shall be from new moon to new moon and from Sabbath to Sabbath, all mankind will come to bow down before me, says Adonai." So from this passage, we can conclude that in the kingdom, new moon celebrations and weekly Sabbaths will be observed on a regular basis. This passage, by the way, is harmonious with the prophet Zechariah's prophecy in chapter 14 about all nations observing the Feast of Tabernacles in the kingdom. In the coming kingdom, pure worship will be reinstated, and all the citizens of his kingdom will be following the rules of that kingdom, which includes the weekly Shabbat and the biblical feasts. So, if the kingdom that Adonai establishes includes the honoring of Shabbat on a weekly basis, we might consider becoming familiar with it now, so we're prepared when that time comes. So now that we have heard from the prophet Isaiah on this topic, what else can we learn from the Tanakh about Shabbat? In the 17th chapter of Jeremiah, as Adonai is chastising the nation of Israel for their continued rampant disregard for his instructions, Jeremiah says this in verses 19 through 27. "Thus Adonai said to me, go and stand in the public gate, through which the kings of Judah come in and go out, as well as in all the gates of Jerusalem, and say to them, listen to the word of Adonai, kings of Judah and all the inhabitants of Jerusalem who come in through these gates. Thus says Adonai, take heed for yourselves, and do not carry any load on the Sabbath day, or bring anything in through the gates of Jerusalem. You shall not bring a load out of your houses on the Sabbath day, nor do any work, but keep the Sabbath day holy, as I commanded your forefathers. Yet they did not listen or incline their ears, but stiffened their necks in order not to listen or take correction. But it will come about, if you listen attentively to me, declares Adonai, to bring no load in through the gates of this city on the Sabbath day, but to keep the Sabbath day holy by doing no work on it, then there will come in through the gates of this city kings and princes sitting on the throne of David, riding in chariots and on horses, they and their princes, the men of Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and this city will be inhabited forever. They will come in from the cities of Judah and from the environs of Jerusalem, from the land of Benjamin, from the lowland, from the hill country, and from the Negev, bringing burnt offerings, sacrifices, grain offerings, and incense, and bringing sacrifices of thanksgiving to the house of Adonai. But if you do not listen to me, to keep the Sabbath day holy by not carrying a load and coming in through the gates of Jerusalem on the Sabbath day, then I will kindle a fire in its gates, and it will devour the palaces of Jerusalem and not be quenched." Of course, we know from the historical record that the kingdom of Judah failed to heed this warning. As a result, this word was fulfilled when the Babylonians came and destroyed Jerusalem and the temple. But the point of reading this passage was to establish that honoring the Shabbat was the linchpin upon which this entire prophecy was hinged. According to the word spoken through Jeremiah, if only the inhabitants of Judah had honored the Shabbat, the Babylonians would have never come. There would have been no exile, and Israel would have never suffered persecution and near annihilation over the last several millennia. All that suffering, frustration, pain, and heartache could have been prevented if only we had obeyed and kept the Sabbath holy as he intended it to be. This passage brings us right back to what we discussed in episode 2 on this topic, the environment Nehemiah would have been operating in. These words of Jeremiah chapter 17 would have been uttered before the children of Israel were sent into captivity, but 100 years later, when Nehemiah returned to the land to rebuild the city and the temple, the words of Jeremiah were undoubtedly still bouncing off the surrounding mountains around the city. It would have been these words of Jeremiah, combined with the words of Isaiah, as we discussed in our last episode, that would have been ringing in Nehemiah's ears as he constructed the city walls and the temple. In fact, it is this carrying a load mentioned by Jeremiah here in chapter 17 that Nehemiah directly references in Nehemiah chapter 13 when he described seeing the people bringing in sacks of grain and loading them on donkeys and carrying all kinds of loads. It was seeing these things that prompted Nehemiah to close the gates of the city and to prevent the merchants from camping outside the city walls on Shabbat. But what exactly does carrying a load mean? This has led to much debate over the years. In fact, within Judaism, there have been many restrictions that have been developed over the centuries surrounding this very topic. On the surface, one might conclude that the prohibition against carrying a load in both Jeremiah 17 and in Nehemiah 13 is limited to carrying something into or out of the city gates, as we see from Jeremiah chapter 17, verse 21, or to carrying something into or out of your home, as we see then in verse 22 of Jeremiah 17. Within Talmudic sources, however, many more restrictions were developed from these verses. This line of logic asks questions like this. If we can't carry a load out of or into our homes, what about into or out of our sukkahs during the Feast of Tabernacles? The Mishnah discussed this at length, and the Mishnah defined two different domains within which these prohibitions existed. It identified the public domain, identified by the city gates in Jeremiah and in Nehemiah, and the private domain, your home, as outlined by Jeremiah 17:22. In the Talmudic writings, there was a connection made between carrying a load and the sin of the man who was caught gathering wood for his fire in Numbers chapter 15. Of course, as we discussed in episode 2, the sin this man committed wasn't about carrying something at all. Instead, his sin was the willful, defiant rebellion against Adonai's instructions about not working on the Sabbath. Nevertheless, in modern Orthodox Judaism, it became a prohibition to carry anything out of your house on Shabbat except the clothing that you're wearing. Even such trivial things as a key or a handkerchief must be left at home on Shabbat if you leave your house. Things like wallets, purses, and in our modern time, one would assume cell phones and tablets would also fit into this category. According to this view, all these items must be left behind if you leave your home and must not be carried. The only things one can carry, according to the most fervent Jewish sources, are things that are worn. So conceivably, jewelry would qualify, as well as clothing. They've gone so far, in fact, that they have said that if Yom Teruah, the Feast of Trumpets, falls on a Shabbat, that it's prohibited to blow the shofar on that day, even though it's commanded to blow the shofar on that day. Because somehow, carrying or even picking up the shofar would be considered to be an abrogation of this instruction from Jeremiah. Now, in your own home, many of these restrictions are lifted, pun fully intended. So, good news, they can pick up and use their toothbrushes. Now, obviously, I'm poking fun at this, but seriously, this is an example of classic overthinking, and it's also an example of doing what Yeshua referred to as straining out a gnat when he says that in Matthew chapter 23. There are hundreds and hundreds of restrictions on Shabbat that have been developed within certain branches of Judaism that cause us to question if Shabbat is not some huge burden instead of being the delight it was intended to be. Examples of this would include not starting a car, because the process of a spark plug firing, as well as engine combustion, would both fall under the category of kindling a fire. The same restriction applies to incandescent light bulbs, because the filament within those bulbs burns. Also, better not let your furnace kick on in the winter, or your water heater turn on to heat water, as those could fall under the category of kindling a fire as well. Or at least, in making the person at the utility department work to provide the power and the gas for those things. Do you see how ridiculous this can get? In fact, there are 39 different categories of Sabbath work that are prohibited by Jewish law, which would include things like tearing being prohibited, because tearing is seen as being something that's work. Thus, in certain homes, toilet paper squares are pre-torn before Shabbat, so that when you need to use the restroom on Shabbat, you don't have to tear the toilet paper. These and hundreds of other cases are examples of what happened during the Second Temple period and beyond. You see, what we might roll our eyes at and disdain in these super restrictive extra rules, they were actually developed with the right motives. They just used the wrong application. After the prophecy of Jeremiah chapter 17, after Nehemiah's warnings, after Isaiah's words, the children of Israel still failed to remain loyal to Adonai's instructions. This then led to the Greek Empire overrunning the land of Israel, which led to the defiling of the temple by Antiochus Epiphanes, which led to the Maccabean Revolt, which led to what we refer to now as the Second Temple period. During this time, during that Second Temple period, the religious Jews finally committed themselves to adhering to the passages we've discussed from the prophets in regard to Shabbat. They were determined not to commit the same mistakes their fathers had in years past. While this was awesome and admirable, unfortunately, it went a bit sideways. You see, the Jewish people of the Second Temple period, they were so determined not to break the commands their fathers had that they developed a whole other set of rules that were in addition to the ones found in Scripture. The thinking was, well, if we set up a fence around the fence, then we'll never cross the inner fence. In this case, the inner fence, so to speak, was the commands found in the Tanakh regarding Shabbat, which we've discussed in this series. The oral law then becomes the outer fence, so to speak, that Judaism has established around the inner fence. This thought process is essentially what has led to all the extra biblical rules found within the oral law. It's also the same thought process that we will see Yeshua encountered in the Gospels on numerous occasions. On that note, let's take a look at what the New Testament has to say on the topic of Shabbat, and we'll see how this immediately ties into what we've been discussing in the last few minutes. The first time we see the topic of Shabbat discussed in the New Testament occurs in Matthew chapter 12, verses 1 through 13, which reads, "At that time, Yeshua went through the grain fields on the Sabbath, and his disciples became hungry and began to pick the heads of grain and eat. But when the Pharisees saw this, they said to him, 'Look, your disciples do what is not lawful on Sabbath.' But he said to them, 'Have you not read what David did when he became hungry, he and his companions, how he entered the house of Elohim, and they ate the consecrated bread, which was not lawful for those with him, but for the priests alone? Or have you not read in the Torah that on the Sabbath the priests in the temple break the Sabbath and are innocent? But I say to you that something greater than the temple is here. But if you had known what this means, 'I desire compassion and not a sacrifice,' you would not have condemned the innocent. For the Son of Man is Kurios, Lord of the Sabbath." Departing from there, he went into their synagogue. And a man was there whose hand was withered, and they questioned Yeshua, asking, "Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath?" so that they might accuse him. And he said to them, "What man is there among you who has a sheep, and if it falls into a pit on the Sabbath, will he not take a hold of it and lift it out? How much more valuable, then, is a man than a sheep? So then, it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath." Then he said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." He stretched it out, and it was restored to normal like the other. Okay, so I wanted to read that passage in its entirety without interrupting with commentary, as difficult as that is for me to accomplish, so that we could get the whole story without pause. But now, let's go back and break down what we just read and see what we can glean from it. So we see that Yeshua is, point number one, going somewhere on Shabbat. Verse 1 says that he was walking through the grain fields. Now we see in verse 9 that he ends up going into the synagogue. So perhaps he and his disciples were simply heading to the synagogue on Shabbat, as was his fashion, as we can see from Luke chapter 4, verse 16, and their path just took them through this grain field. But we're not given that specific information, we just know that they were walking. On the surface, this seems just fine. But a little later, we'll get into the concept of something called a Sabbath day journey. But for now, we see that while he was walking through the grain fields, point number two comes up. He and his disciples began picking heads of grain to eat. Interestingly enough, when they see him doing this, the Pharisees don't accuse Yeshua and his disciples of theft. I mean, this is someone else's field that they're gleaning from. How would that not be considered theft? The answer lies in passages such as Leviticus chapter 19, verses 9 and 10, Leviticus chapter 23, verse 22, and Deuteronomy chapter 24, verses 19 through 22. All of these verses speak of leaving certain portions of your field unharvested so that the poor, the widow, the orphan, and the stranger can glean from it when they're hungry. So, technically speaking, Yeshua and his disciples could have claimed poverty, as none of them appeared to have any type of stable employment at this stage. But it's pretty telling that this is not the tact that the Pharisees used to criticize them with. Instead, point number three, the Pharisees' response. The Pharisees, seeing Yeshua and his disciples plucking heads of grain, say to him, "Your disciples do what is not lawful to do on a Sabbath." Which part are they referring to? The plucking of the grain? The harvesting of grain? The act of removing the husk in order to consume it? You see, if you were to pluck a grain of wheat off of a stalk of wheat, you can't just pop it in your mouth. You have to remove the husk, and in order to do so, you have to take that grain and you have to rub it in your hand with vigor so that that husk is removed and you can blow that husk away so that you can get to the kernel, which is what you want to eat. The husk is not edible. Well, that act of grinding your hands together was seen as work. That's yet another area that the Pharisees are addressing here. So, which part did the Pharisees object to? The plucking of the grain? The harvesting? The grinding? Yes, all the above. You see, plucking, harvesting, and removing the husk would all be considered work. Something a farmer would do with his field of crops. Only the disciples weren't farmers. This wasn't their field. And they weren't harvesting in order to sell the grain for profit. Nor were they attempting to gather it to store it away and sell it later. In fact, farming wasn't their profession at all. So, were they actually working? Well, that depends upon who you're asking. You see, the oral law would state that this was indeed considered work. By that definition, if you go into your kitchen on Shabbat and open a jar of peanut butter and spread it on a slice of bread, that could also be considered work. Opening the jar requires force. Spreading the peanut butter requires you to pick up a knife and apply it to something. Both of these, if we apply rabbinic interpretation methods, could be considered to be work. Which is why Yeshua answers the way he does when they level their accusation, which is point four. Yeshua points to the principle behind the commands of Sabbath, as well as the other commands found within the Torah. What do I mean? Well, to answer that, let's look at how Yeshua responds to this accusation. Yeshua replies to these Pharisees by citing the story from 1 Samuel chapter 21, where David and his companions are fleeing from Saul and Saul's wrath against David. This comes directly on the heels of chapter 20, which details the covenant David and Jonathan, the son of Saul, make with one another, and the plan they devised to inform David of Saul's intentions. In this chapter, chapter 20, Jonathan informs David that he needs to flee because Saul has become so jealous of David's reputation that he's plotting to kill him. So in his haste to leave, David and his companions, they didn't even take provisions with them. David left Ramah, which is about 10 miles or so north of Jerusalem, and he fled to Shiloh, which is about another 10 miles or so north of there. It just so happened that Shiloh was where the tabernacle rested. So David and his men, having fled on foot, had likely jogged the 10 miles from Ramah to Shiloh. When they arrived, they were famished, as one might imagine after such physical exertion. So David approaches the priest, who is currently ministering in the tabernacle, named Ahimelech, which, by the way, means "my brother is king." And he asks Ahimelech for food. Now Ahimelech tells David that the only food he has there is the showbread, which had just recently been replaced, as was commanded to be done every 7 days, where the priesthood had to put new, fresh showbread in the tabernacle every 7 days, and they would remove it. The problem here, this bread, this holy consecrated bread, was to only be consumed by the priests, and it could only be consumed within the confines of the tabernacle by those priests. So David ends up convincing this priest Ahimelech that it would be okay for Ahimelech to give David the consecrated bread so that he could give it to his men. Was it? Nope, not at all. But this speaks to the greater principle that is exactly the point Yeshua is making here in Matthew chapter 12. That principle is something that I very briefly alluded to in episode 2 when we were discussing the definition of what constituted work. Before I state what that principle is, though, let's go back to the words of Yeshua, because he says it in a few different ways. In verses 3 and 4, Yeshua gives the example that we just read about of David eating the showbread. In verse 5, he then brings up that the priests and Levites, when they serve in the temple on Shabbat, that they're in violation of the very same oral laws, as well as the commands found within the Torah, to abstain from work on the Sabbath. After all, what the priests and Levites did in the temple was their job. It was work. They tended to the fire on the altar, which included carrying wood. They also tended to the fire in the menorah. They had to butcher animals for sacrifice. All these things were in direct conflict with specific biblical commands, which we've covered, regarding abstaining from all types of work. Why were the priests and Levites seemingly exempt from these restrictions? Yeshua then pauses and drops an absolute bomb. He says, "Something greater than the temple is here." And we'll discuss this in a future program, but I would be remiss if I didn't point out this amazing statement he made here in the midst of this passage. Then in verse 7, Yeshua quotes from Hosea chapter 6, verse 6, when he says, "But if you had known what this means, I desire compassion and not sacrifice, you would not have condemned the innocent." Why did he quote from Hosea? Well, we'll see in just a moment how all these things tie together. So hang in there with me for a few more minutes. Back to Matthew chapter 12. After having finally silenced these Pharisees, at least in regard to their concerns about his disciples plucking wheat on the Sabbath and eating it, Yeshua then enters the synagogue, where a different tactic is attempted. As he enters this synagogue, he's met with a question. Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? This question is asked within the context of a man who's in attendance at that synagogue who had a hand that was unusable due to either some type of deformity or some type of accident. But it says immediately after the question being posed, the motivation for asking the question was exposed so that they might accuse him. It was a trap. They wanted Yeshua to say something against Torah so that they could label him as a teacher of falsehoods and thus destroy his credibility. Yeshua responds by asking, "What man is there among you who has a sheep? And if it falls into a pit on the Sabbath, will he not take a hold of it and lift it out?" But wait, wouldn't picking up a sheep break the instruction to avoid carrying a load? Yep, exactly. But Yeshua illustrates that the threat of breaking that command wouldn't have stopped the owner of the sheep from delivering his sheep from its plight. After asking this rhetorical question, Yeshua follows up with, "How much more valuable, then, is a man than a sheep? So, then, it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath." And there it is, the principle we've been looking for. It is lawful to do good on the Sabbath. This is the principle Yeshua is communicating. Doing good overrules a prohibition. If there are two seemingly conflicting scriptures, there is a theological principle that is to be followed. The principle is referred to within Jewish thought by the phrase kal v'chomer, which literally means easy and hard or light and heavy. This phrase communicates that when there are two opposing views or conflicting verses, that the one that carries more weight or the heavier result is the one that takes priority. Another way to view this is positive versus negative. To explain in simpler terms, if there is a positive commandment, as an example, to love your neighbor as yourself, as we see in Leviticus chapter 19, verse 18, if that positive commandment is seemingly conflicting with a negative commandment, such as do no work on the Sabbath, then the positive commandment is the one that you should follow, even at the expense of the negative one. Another way of viewing this principle is to say that a commandment which sustains life takes priority over a commandment that isn't concerned with sustaining life, but is about something else entirely. This is the reason why, if you were to visit Israel today, you would find that while the rest of the country pretty much shuts down on Shabbat, all the military bases, police stations, firehouses, and hospitals, they all remain open and functioning on the Sabbath. While the soldier, the police officer, the firefighter, and the nurse, the doctor, and the hospital staff are technically in breach of the commandment to cease from labor when they work on Shabbat, the reason they are working is in order to sustain and preserve life. This principle takes priority over everything else. If you become injured on Shabbat, or had a fire in your home, or in any way needed these services and they weren't functioning, you'd find yourself potentially in dire straits. But because they remain open and functioning, if anything were to happen, you would have a solution. Professionals who are trained in ways that are designed to sustain and preserve life would be attending to you and your situation. The alternative, these services being shut down, could prove to be potentially calamitous. And that's why this principle exists. We see this is the answer for each of the scenarios listed in Matthew chapter 12. When the disciples were plucking grain and eating it, they were sustaining their lives. They were eating, they weren't harvesting. David and his men were eating to sustain their strength for their flight in order to preserve their lives from the danger of execution. The priests and the Levites were serving the entire nation, providing a way for anyone who desired to do so to be able to approach Adonai. This is why Yeshua quoted from Hosea 6, "It's the heart of the matter that's important. The benefit to mankind and the blessing of others is of greater importance than the instructions themselves." That is why Adonai said through the prophet Hosea, "For I delight in loyalty rather than sacrifice, and in the knowledge of Elohim than in burnt offerings." In other words, sacrifices are meaningless unless they're presented from a heart of worship desiring intimacy. He would rather have a Daniel who prayed 3 times a day, facing Jerusalem, serving Adonai with all he had, willing to be thrown into the lion's den for the sake of his testimony, despite his lack of access to an altar. Adonai would rather have that than to have those who do have access to that altar bringing sacrifices that are devoid of any real commitment to him, but who instead do so strictly out of obligation. To put it in other words, he would rather see those who claim to be his children defying the laws of their land and risking their lives and freedom in order to meet in underground churches to worship him than for those who have ready access to churches on every street corner deciding to sleep in instead of gathering together with other like-minded believers. Ouch. Did I hit a nerve there? Do you remember in episode 1 how we discussed Leviticus 23, where it said that Adonai called the Sabbath a Mikra Kodesh, a holy convocation? This is an instruction for us to gather together with other believers. This phrase is used to speak specifically and exclusively about Shabbat and the biblical feast days. Those are days on which Adonai has commanded us to gather together, to encourage one another, and to bless Adonai together. When we gather together with like-minded believers, we are presented with the opportunity to bless others with our spiritual gifts and to be blessed by them and their spiritual gifts. The reality is that none of us has it all right. None of us has it all together. None of us has all the answers. We all have a piece of the puzzle. But together, we're able to plug into one another, and the entire puzzle begins to come into view. This is why we're commanded to have a Mikra Kodesh, a holy gathering on Shabbat. In Adonai's calendar, there are no loner observances. We don't get to do them by ourselves. That's not a true fulfillment of the commands concerning Shabbat, nor is it a true fulfillment of the commands concerning the biblical festivals. We are all different parts of the body, but those parts have to come together in order for the body to actually go somewhere. This is exactly why Paul spends the majority of chapter 12 of 1 Corinthians discussing this very topic. Starting in verse 12, he says, "For even as the body is one, and yet has many members, and all the members of the body, though there are many, are one body, so also is Messiah. For the body is not one member, but many. But now Elohim has placed the members, each one of them, in the body, just as he desired. But Elohim has composed the body, giving more abundant honor to that member which lacked, so that there may be no division in the body, but that the members may have the same care for one another. And if one member suffers, all the members suffer with it. If one member is honored, all the members rejoice with it. Now you are Messiah's body and individually members of it." As individual members of the body of Messiah, we all bring different gifts, skills, and talents to the table when we meet together. Some are gifted in areas where others are not. unless we are all together, we end up lacking in many of these areas. But once we do gather all together, all the gifts become evident and we are encouraged. If we aren't meeting with other believers on a regular basis, we are deprived of the blessing that comes through interaction. We can see this type of interaction taking place at events like Shavuot and Sukkot, where we can gather together in large numbers and encourage one another. It is such a blessing to meet with other believers, to make lifelong friends, and to glean from one another and encourage each other. Personal contact with other believers is not merely a suggestion that the Bible makes. It's commanded. Relationships with others is the way we are encouraged to live out the faith that we proclaim to have. Think about it. How can you love your neighbor as yourself if you don't ever interact with your neighbors? This is why the author of the book of Hebrews says in chapter 10, verses 23 through 25, "Let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who promised is faithful. And let us consider how to stimulate one another to love and good deeds, not forsaking our own assembling together, as is the habit of some, but encouraging one another, and all the more as you see the day drawing near." When Adonai created Adam, he saw that man by himself was incomplete. We need interaction with others. It's how we're designed. "But Daniel," you might say, "there are no like-minded believers near me with whom I can gather. What am I supposed to do?" This is a very unique challenge, and one I don't envy at all, to be sure. My heart goes out to those of you who find yourself in such a scenario. Even for those of us who live in areas where we have access to congregations and fellowships, as the coronavirus situation continues to grip our world, it's becoming much more difficult to gather together as government restrictions begin to affect all attempts to gather. Thankfully, we live in a day and age where we have the medium of the internet, where we can virtually gather with one another. While this may be less than ideal, it still offers us the ability to, at least to a certain extent, allow iron to sharpen iron. Through the opportunities provided by an interconnected world, we can gather with one another even when separated by thousands of miles, or kilometers, if you prefer. Now, while virtual gatherings are one way to satisfy the desire we all have to interact with other believers, the problem is it's far from perfect. Direct interaction is still at the heart of a mikrokodesh, and this is exactly why Adonai commanded us to meet together on Shabbat. Someday, someday, and may it be soon, Lord Yeshua, we will all be free to gather together and have Shabbat, all the time. Until that day arrives, though, and we're all in the kingdom together, we should devote ourselves to the quest of meeting with like-minded believers as often as we can practically do so. I highly encourage you to investigate what ways you can find others around you with whom you can have fellowship. You can, of course, always see the events that we host at Lion and Lamb Ministries on our website at lionandlambministries.org. These events would afford you the opportunity to gather with us. Of course, there are many ministries all over the world that also arrange gatherings that may be geographically much closer to you, and we would encourage you to take advantage of those opportunities where they exist. If you would like to obtain more information on this topic, please feel free to contact us at info@lionlamb.net, and we'll be happy to see if we can help you in this effort. And on that note, we come to an end of our fourth episode on the topic of Shabbat. Please join us for our next episode as we continue our journey through the New Testament verses that speak about the topic of the Sabbath, and we'll glean from the Word together. Until then, Shalom.